My name is Deborah Schwartz, and I'm sitting here with Doug Ferguson. It is May 31st, 2015. Doug?
Yes.
Thank you very much for sitting down with me.
Thank you for coming.
Letting me chat with you at your beautiful home here. Let's start with some basic information. When and where were you born?
I was born in what I thought was Berkeley, but it was Oakland. It was just across the line from Berkeley, and my family told me I was born in Berkeley, but it turns out I was born in Oakland, California, mm-hmm. in 1939.
Mm-hmm. And your parents, where'd they come from?
My parents came from, my mother was born in Berkeley, my father, his parents came down from the valley, and he was born in Berkeley as well. So my grandchildren now are fourth or fifth generation Californians.
So let's go back a little and just with the original people that came to this country from Ferguson. We've got a...
My grandfather and my great-grandfather in this country were Scottish, mm-hmm. and my father was born in the Bay Area to his father, Ferguson, John Ferguson. My father was Kenneth Ferguson, and he married Constance Pedder, who was the daughter of an Englishman. My grandfather on the other side was English, so I've got English and Scottish.
Mm-hmm. And you were born in Oakland.
Yep.
And how about a little information about basic education and what brought you here to Mill Valley?
Born in Oakland, lived in Berkeley, went to the Berkeley Public Schools, John Muir Grammar School, Willard Junior High School, and Berkeley High School. From there, I departed and went on to Harvard College, and after 3 years, went to Stanford Law School. I didn't graduate from Harvard College because I was hot to get married. Not for any reason having to do with incestuous difficulties, but I was just tired of going to school. So I left early and went to Stanford Law School. And that's what got me into the law biz, mm-hmm. to the extent that I'm in the law biz.
Mm-hmm. And so your wife is Jane, correct?
My wife is Jane. She comes from New England. Mm-hmm. I married her after I met her at a Harvard-Wellesley mixer in 1960 or so. No, that's when we got married. 58. Met her in 58, we got married in 60, and have been married ever since.
So you were hot to marry Jane when you came back.
That's
who
I was hot to marry.
Yeah, found your East Coast lady and came to the West Coast and then went to school at Stanford.
Yeah.
Okay, and you have three children?
I have three children, three sons. They are Seth and Aaron and Joshua. Mm-hmm. And they are now in their mid-50s, and they all live here in two of them live in Marin County, and one lives in Alameda. So we're all very close to home.
So when did you come to Mill Valley? I mean, what brought you to this side of the bridge?
Oh, Mill Valley, 19... Jane! No, let's see. I think...
Closest.
When did we come to Mill Valley?
When did we come to Mill Valley?
Yeah.
I think it was late 68.
That's what I was going to say. 67. Okay, I'm good.
No, not 67.
Oh, well, you're correcting me. That's all right. But anyway, yeah.
No, because Josh was born in this house and I was pregnant when we came.
Okay.
So it was either late 68 or early 69.
Okay, thank you.
Fact check.
Yeah, fact check.
So... What brought you? How did you end up in Mill Valley? I mean, you could have ended up in Berkeley.
I could have ended up in Berkeley and probably would have ended up in Berkeley. All my friends were in Berkeley. And I had spent my entire life there, birth to when I went out one evening with my pals. I had a few drinks, and we got lost going across the Golden Gate Bridge and ended up in Sausalito. And it was a very foggy night, and we pulled in there. I was in the 11th grade or so, and I looked around this foggy, foggy place and looked at the water and heard some seals barking, and I said, "Where are we?" I was so insular, so parochial. I had never been to Marin County. I'd
you
lived
grew
my entire
up in
life.
Oakland, and you never crossed a bridge?
Never crossed the bridge until that night. And I said, "Where are we? I love this place. And I'm going to I want to find out more about this place." And so I came back and started looking into Marin County. And this is a long time ago. Marin County was a very wonderful, different place. And I said, "This is it." So when I married Jane, I said, "When we get out of law school, I want to go live in Marin County. I probably want to live in Sausalito, as a matter of fact, because that's what I fell in love with." So we moved to Sausalito, and that's where we started our life together.
And that's a good story. Your parents never, you never took a little side trip over here?
They were from Berkeley, and Berkeley people knew that that was where the sun rose and the sun set.
So you said Mill Valley in this area was very different. Tell me about how very different it was. What was, how did it?
Well, it wasn't different so much in one respect. Berkeley was, had its fair number of hippies and laid back characters and funny guys, which I loved. And so to the extent that Marin had those characters, that was not that different.
Mm-hmm.
What made it different was its agricultural orientation and it's and the number of people that really loved the land. In Berkeley, there were a bunch of folks who cared about the land and would go up hiking in the Sierra and helping the Sierra Club and this kind of thing, but there was no agriculture there to speak of when I grew up. But when I came over here and found out that stuff was actually growing right around me and that people were helping cows with milk right around me, I thought this was fascinating to me. It just tweaked all kinds of things for me, and I just wanted to find out more about this place. I didn't know that I wanted to live here. I haven't moved one iota since I moved here. I've never fallen in love with any place.
So from Sausalito, with its mists and its foghorns and its cool evenings, yet there were, was there dairy cows over there at the time? Were you, you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I had a sport car. I had an MGTC, and I drove it all over Marin, up, down, and sideways, and I learned about all the places. I just read in this weekend's paper, there's a things about all the things you can see in Marin, and I thought, I saw them all in the first year, 55 years ago. And I've seen them ever since. I love this place. It absolutely captivates me. And when friends come from around the world and say, "You've lived your whole life in one place, do you ever travel?" I said, "Yes, I have. It only confirms that this is a very special place. I'm not leaving here except in a box."
So you're a hometown boy.
I am a hometown boy.
And so from Sausalito, not so far away, to Mill Valley.
Right.
Just a few miles. When did that happen?
Well, Jane was just here. She said we moved into this house in 67.
So you were living in the early 60s in Sausalito.
Sausalito. And then we moved here in 67.
And what brought you to Mill Valley from, I mean, Sausalito is very nice.
Sausalito was very nice, but unfortunately we had one child and another in the hopper.
Mm-hmm.
And we were concerned about the school system, my wife particularly. She's a teacher. And she said, I think we should look afield. And so we looked, because we did not believe in private schools. We thought public schools are great. And so we looked afield and looked into Mill Valley, and bingo.
I mean, you could have gone to Kenfield or Ross or...
I loved Sausalito because I love docks, and I like the people who live around docks, and I like people who are very down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
I would not be comfortable then, would not have been comfortable then, and wouldn't be comfortable now in Ross and Kentfield. They're entitled to live the life they lead, I've just moved my law practice back to Sausalito. This tomorrow is my first official day in Sausalito, but I am going to be here until I'm put down.
Mm-hmm. So you're a wharf rat now.
I'm a wharf rat.
Okay, so you had your law practice for some time though in San Francisco.
Oh, or, yes, I did. Yeah.
And then to
I should have said that. Yes, I got married in 1960. Mm-hmm. And from 60 to 67, I practiced law in San Francisco. And then 68 was when I came to Mill Valley.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the way, congratulations on a long, happy marriage.
Thank you. They are all interesting, and they are all not without blemish. And when people talk to about marriage, say, well, it must have been wonderful. You've been married for so long without me. I said, listen, all I can tell you is we made it.
Mm-hmm.
One article I saw said about old people, they said, how did you stay married so long? And said, neither of us died. Ours is a much happier relationship than that, but I love that line.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit. I mean, I haven't introduced you and what you've done to the area, but we are getting an idea in this interview, or I am, of your profound appreciation for the land and the beauty of the area.
Yeah.
And you've manifested that appreciation, you've demonstrated that appreciation in your professional life.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, I mean, we know about the movie Rebels with a Cause. Some people that are going to be listening to this interview may or may not know about it, but you have obviously are quite well known for the Marincello, and some of the other land conservation efforts made in the Marin County area.
Many battles, many successes.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about.
Okay.
Let's hear your story.
When I come out of the movie that you just mentioned, the Marincello movie, people say, well, how can I find something that's as exciting as what you did with Marincello? And I say, well, I've done a number of things, and I would say, just keep your eyes open and then do it. Then don't think about it. If something needs doing, just do it. That I'm talking in the context of land conservation and people conservation, and I have more than a handful of times just done it. The reason there's a China Camp State Park is in large part due to my just doing it. I was concerned that China Camp, the place, was going to go away, and so I found out that a Chinese or Japanese developer was going to take over China Camp and build a lot of condominiums and hotels, et cetera, at China Camp.
And what year are we talking here?
Oh, golly, I don't know, but I would say...
Close, this is good, you know, decade.
60s, 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, that can't be. So I did a little research in my law library and found out that there was an argument that that land had already been dedicated to the public by their free usage of it for many, many years under the doctrine of ancient rights, etc. So I filed a lawsuit. Huey Johnson, the fellow who founded the Trust for Public Land, and I often went out into the dark with our swords and sabers rattling, and I filed the lawsuit, and he just provided some general support, and that lawsuit did not win. But by the time we got through the court process, the state of California had become highly embarrassed about the fact that some couple of guys from the wharves in Mill Valley were trying to save something the state had failed to save. And so they moved forward and acquired China Camp. Just the other day, I was down looking at a project down by Tam Junction, and that has a new thing where you can look out and see about the water is going to rise, and there's a new installation where you can envision the water rising. And I thought, and the lady there said, do you have much acquaintance with this area? And I said, yes, I do. As a matter of fact, where we're standing would have been a shopping center, but for me and Huey Johnson. He and I decided that it was a really bum idea to let development come into this, so we stepped forward and made a few friends and did a few things. And Tam Junction.
The marshlands over
the
there.
The marshlands.
With Mrs. Terwilliger
yeah.
doing her
you bet,
night
you
work.
Bet.
Yeah.
Those things happened. There have been a number of such events.
Well, you simply had the ability, because of your training as an attorney, to see something, and then you jumped. You just
yeah.
threw yourself at it.
Yeah. They were going to build a hotel, a massive hotel, right in front of Sausalito, right in the water, besides where Sausalito sits. And I just had come from Stanford Law School. My first month in Sausalito, I went down to the Sausalito Planning Commission to see what was going on. I thought I should find out about this town. And they heard about John Lord King and his plans to build a massive hotel complex right in front of where Viña del Mar Park is today. And I said, that can't be. So I went to the law library and looked into it and came to the conclusion that the public trust for navigation and commerce precluded this development, and that all John Lord King could do was to build a development that respected the right to navigate and fish. So I looked into it and went to the Sausalito city attorney and to the city council and said, do you realize that John Lord King, nice man that he may be, though I knew otherwise, cannot do this? And they said, well, we're going to hand this to our city attorney. And the city attorney came back and said, you know what, the kid's right. There is a public trust for navigation and commerce, and that precludes the construction of things that prevent navigation, fishing, and watertime commerce. And I said, well, that's cool. And John Lord King looked at me and said, young man, do you know who you're talking to? I said, the former developer?
Cheeky.
I've always been irreverent. And he just about had apoplexy on the spot. But that was the last time I saw him, because he was history.
You know, but don't you ponder the fact that these developments come forward without the people, actually the city attorneys and so on, being aware of the precedent that's set?
Well, he had done a very clever job. He had bought all the underwater lots in the water in front of Sausalito. They had been, Sausalito back in the 1850s, had run a land scam and sold underwater lots to unsuspecting Eastern investors so that they could raise money to help develop Sausalito. So a bunch of people all over the United States held deeds to lots, underwater lots.
They thought they weren't underwater? Or they
no,
thought
they, didn't,
they, could
they
purchase...
didn't know. Hey, it's way up in California. They'd heard about this wonderful opportunity to be in the San Francisco Bay. And when I found out that they were underwater, I said, holy moly, we're going to have a good time with this. And so it came to pass. They couldn't be developed. And John Lord King had never had a good attorney say, have you ever heard about the public trust for navigation?
How do you explain that?
Well, I explain it as follows. I was taught something very valuable by my mentor in law. When I went up my first law job, it was a wonderful man, Willard Johnston, and he said, before you look up what the law is, think what the law should be. Think what the world would be if it were a better place. What do you want to happen? Let that be your guide before you start doing your research. And that's absolutely the way I felt all these years. In Sausalito, I said, this can't be. So I went to find the cases that said, this can't be, and bingo, the public trust for navigation and commerce popped right out. If I was looking for this can be, I would have been off into some other tangent.
You
but
found what you were looking for.
I found what I was looking for, the right answer. And it's been a very consistent guide to results that people sometimes are surprised by.
Because you take a moment to logic what the right thing would be, and then you trust that
yeah.
that will have happened.
I'm not God, but I like God, though. I think I'm right. So do we all.
Corroboration.
Yeah. So I just looked to find in the laws of the state of California the things that will tell me that this is going to go this way. I did this once with a client. This is not a conservation matter, but a client who said, my God, this fellow is, I was just out of law school, this fellow has cheated me, and he was my partner, and he's cheated me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that doesn't sound right. And so I looked into, I went to see this very same gentleman, my mentor. And he said, well, what do you think the law should be about that? Let's talk about that, you and me. And I said, well, it seems to me if people are partners, they can't be landlord and tenant because they're two different relationships. Landlord and tenant is a one-way street. Partners is an equality and a fraternity and a high fiduciary standard. He said, I think you're onto something. Go find out. And I did. And the first, in the first term of the Supreme Court in California, the case of Pio Pico versus Cuyas established the fact that the relationship between landlord and tenant is antithetical to that of partners, and therefore this whole development that these guys wanted to do, screwing the other guys, etc., was not possible if they were partners. You can't be a landlord and tenant with a partner. And I went back to Willard Johnson. I said, you're prescient. He said, no, I wasn't. I was thinking, you and I were both thinking, and now you've learned what I'm telling you. Think about what the law should be, and maybe it will be that way. Holy moly, this has been great. It's been my guiding light all these years.
What kind of attorney exactly did you get? You know, did you have a specialty, or are you just a general attorney, or a conservationist attorney?
I don't even identify myself sometimes as an attorney in polite society because so many people have beliefs as to what attorneys are, what they do, how they think, what they feel. I am somebody who wants to do good in this world. And I also need to make a living. So if I can make a living doing good, or at least not doing bad, that's what I do. So I am a business and real estate lawyer with a lot of knowledge about estate planning and a lot of knowledge about land stuff and conservation matters as applies to estate planning. But that's not the only things I've done. I've always said, the lady who works with me now, my office manager, still remembers when she came 15 years ago, said, well, what should I expect? And I said, don't expect anything. Nothing in this office is the same day to day. The people who walk in the door are different. The problems are different. The issues are different. That's what I like. I have a short attention span. If you like to do things in great detail, you're in the wrong place.
So you jumped into the skirmish with the developer in Sausalito and with in Tam Junction with you and Huey. Where else have you jumped? What other things have you done locally?
Locally.
I mean, it can be contiguous to Mill Valley. I mean, open spaces. And
I've stopped the over in. Sorry, trying to remember the place. The old Japanese couple, China Camp.
Mm-hmm.
China Camp.
Mm-hmm.
That was going to be developed too. And using my very complicated logic, that's how I got the state parks to come in there. I've worked out in West Marin on a number of matters. There was a development in where we stopped another coastal development because there was a whole yet another new doctrine that had come up. That was the Jug Handle Creek's ecological staircase. A guy called me on my birthday 100 years ago and said, we've got to do something, don't we? This is John Olmsted, a magnificent, wonderful, free-spirited guy, part of the Olmsted family that had been naturalists for years and years. He said, we got to do something, Doug. And I said, do I know you? He said, yes, we met somewhere. But Doug, we've got to go do something because the bulldozers are moving as we speak and they're going to tear up the whole beginning of the Jug Handle Creek ecological staircase.
And that is located where?
In Mendocino, north of Mendocino.
North over by Point Arena?
By Casper.
By Casper.
And I said, well, what are the grounds for stopping this? And he said, well, you're the lawyer. I said, well, when do we need to do something? He said, I think if we don't do it today, it's going to be too late. The bulldozers are going to go start cratering the cliffs and the things. I said, well, okay, this is 6 a.m, he called me. I'm very proud of this. We got the injunction that afternoon in the Mendocino County Capitol at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I found a case at 7 o'clock that had just been decided by the California Supreme Court saying that there was a new law that had to do with environmental impact statements, and that had to do with state projects, projects funded by the state. And in a footnote, they said, when asked would this apply to private projects, we expressed no opinion. And I said, that's all I need. I think it should apply to private projects too. I think the California Environmental Quality Act should definitely apply to private projects, just as it applies to state projects. And on that basis, I went to the court in Mendocino and then to the Supreme Court, and we stopped the project, got the injunction, and went forward.
Did you work with Huey on that one too?
No, I worked with John Olmsted. John Olmsted and Huey are both very similar in that nobody can work with both of them. They're very, very unusual people. I love unusual people. My good wife says, I don't see how you can get along with the people you work with. And I say, because they're unusual. That's what I love about them. And so that's that. That was the Jug Handle Creek. I'm sorry, I didn't think to write down. I have a whole bunch of documents that I can give you.
You can provide that for us later. But I mean,
I have worked on a great variety of environmental matters. I get a big kick out of it. I love the land. I love the people who love land. And I've been very successful in fussing around with land that was getting tampered with. And I don't like that. And so
don't mess with Ferguson. Don't mess with the land. How about Slide Ranch?
Well, Slide Ranch is a separate one. That was a very interesting one. And dear to my heart, when my father died, I was driving up the coast shortly thereafter, just from San Francisco going up the coast, I don't know why. And I pulled off the road and looked down and said, holy moly, what is this? This is the most beautiful place. I see, notwithstanding the fact that I had lived here a while, I was born in Berkeley, and I didn't know of any nook and cranny, and I didn't know about Slide Ranch. I mean, I looked at it, this is a magnificent, I mean, we're looking at that picture I just showed. It's a lovely place. The one right where I was in the next room. That's where I was standing when I said this, aha, what is this place? It's Slide Ranch. And I went to the county, drove from right there directly to the county offices, went to the assessor's office and said, who owns this thing? And the guy there said, oh, yeah. That's Slide Ranch. It's owned by, let's see, this is guy, his address is in Los Angeles. I said, what? What's he doing about that? He says, I don't know how he got it there, but it's been there. It was in farming and ranching, and but mostly dairy from the 1860s. I don't know what this guy in Los Angeles is doing with it. So I looked into it and found out that the Portuguese family that had owned the place had run out of money, and a guy, from Los Angeles, a Hollywood script writer, had bought the property with the hopes of building hotels on it. There it would be. He'd have the greatest hotels in the world, right on the ocean, looking out to Hawaii. And I said, well, that can't be. That doesn't make any sense at all. For one thing, I had done a little research and found out that Slide Ranch was called Slide Ranch because it was sliding into the ocean and was eventually going to end up in China or someplace. And I said, this is a bad place to build hotels, and that should affect the value of the place. So I contacted the Hollywood scriptwriter. Now, I am, at this point, 1 year out of law school. He had paid, I don't know what, not a whole lot of money. He would never tell me for the property. And he thought
it was worth it. How many acres is Slide?
150 acres. And he thought that it was worth a lot of money, many, many, many millions of dollars, because it was so beautiful. And it was beautiful, and it is beautiful. And I said, well, but sir, do you realize that it is unstable? He said, that's not for me to worry about. I'm worried about what I can get for it. Let somebody else worry about whether it goes into the ocean. This was not a nice man. The people who lived on the ranch were his tenants. He had put them there simply to keep people from getting onto the land, and they were not nice people. They, it turned out, were running the cocaine dealing for Marin County at the time. And
this is what year?
What?
What year is this?
This is 1960.
This must be late. Huh? God, they had cocaine in 63.
Yeah. This is early stuff. That was their major drug, and they were dealing, and it was a very, very strange and scruffy bunch of people. They lived out there as tenants of this guy, and they had some horses, and they would go riding with their horses and wire cutters with them so they could just cut the fences. And they didn't like to stop and try to open doors or ask permission. They just cut. They were really bad people. And very themselves used a lot of their products, so they were not people that were easy to talk to. And I eventually said, well, I think we can do something here, something. So I persuaded, slowly but surely, I did some research and found out that this Hollywood scriptwriter, thinking he was really bright, had sold 1/4 of an acre of the 150 acres to PG&E so that they could create a saltwater testing station to put products on there and see how quickly they rotted. And when they did that, they charged $25,000 for that 1/4 acre. Well, the assessor can do the math. And he did the math with my assistance and said, we've got to bump the taxes on this. This was being taxed at $13,000. You just know we haven't remembered. The taxes went up something like 5,000 times. I had a huge, huge bump. I called the Hollywood scriptwriter and said, how is everything going? He says, oh, yes, everything's fine. Everything's fine. I said, I was bumped into some information about the assessor. He says, oh, that's all wrong. They can't do that to me. But I said, well, I just happen to know about it. Anyway, I'd still like to resume our discussion about the value of this property. And slowly but surely, it took 3.5 years, this negotiation. The good lady you just met, my wife, after about 2 years said, Chuck, drop it. He's never going to consent to you. You're just a kid. He's thinking big numbers. Just give it up. I said, no. I'm making progress. It's incremental. It's very baby steps, but I'm making progress. And lo and behold, after about 3.5 years, something, I think it was that tax adjustment, did it to him. And he said, you know, I might be willing to think about it. I said, well, let me tell you something. You've never been open-minded enough to let me tell you about bargain sales. Bargain sales is when you think this property is worth, I think you told me, $10 million. I don't happen to agree with you, but that's for you and the assessor and the Lord to decide. If you want to give this property to a charity and say it's worth $10 million, you might have a $10 million tax deduction. You might also go to jail. I think I would be much more conservative than that in saying what it was worth. But you can anyway, you're not limited to the amount that you get. And he says, what do you mean the amount that I get? I said, I'm prepared to make you an offer for Slide Ranch. I have lined up the Nature Conservancy to be the charitable recipient of this property. And I have also separately lined up, I didn't tell him, but it was family money. My father having died, he had left me and my brother and sister some money, and I persuaded them that we should put $150,000 into a memorial for my father. It's not known as a memorial, because we didn't want to do it that way. It was private. But the $150,000 went to the Hollywood scriptwriter, who then, having sold it to the trust through me to the Nature Conservancy, what he told the Internal Revenue Service that land was worth? I'll never know. I think I know. I think he was something around $10 million, something like that. But it was only $150,000 for 150 acres.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was a good deal. It was a good deal. In today's world, you wouldn't have to worry about development. If the people who live in Marin County, I could sell that for $100 million or $200 million. It's such a beautiful piece of property.
Spectacular property.
Yeah. But anyway, so we bought it, and then suddenly it was in the hands of the Nature Conservancy, and they said, what are we going to do with this? And so, like, once again, my contact was Huey Johnson. We are old pals. He said, who could run this place? I said, I don't know. He said, well, let me look around. And he came up with a group that sounded wonderful. They're called the, I can't remember. Frontier Arts Institute. They were a group of do-gooders that were going to take care of land and help kids learn about nature.
Mm-hmm.
Sounded great. And I went out and talked to them a few times, and I said, Huey, this group, I like them, but they're a little scruffy. They don't seem to know anything about nature. He says, yeah, I was kind of impressed with that too, but, you know, they say the right things. I'm sure it'll all work out. I did more research and found out it was the road crew from the Grateful Dead, who, when they weren't on the road, would go out and relax at Sly Branch, and who told Huey that they were the Frontier Arts Institute, and that they, we can do nature. And so they maintained that facade, and Huey helped persuade the Park Service that the Frontier Arts Institute would be an excellent steward for the land. And so the Park Service acquired the land from the Nature Conservancy and leased it back to the Frontier Arts Institute. I mean, this is very incestuous stuff. And the net result of it was that the Slide Ranch, aka the Frontier Arts Institute at the time, had a home. Mr. Ferguson had found them a home. The money had all gone to wherever the money goes. And that's why they are there today.
And they, of course, the local schools, I remember my own son, they would have their field trips or their sleepovers. You know, they became specialists.
It became very legit. It's a legit.
Build it and they will come.
Yeah.
So, interesting story.
Yeah, it's really.
And how about further along the coast? Any other projects in West Marin?
I'm only talking about the things I've done purely on my own. I have been, since its foundation, because Huey was the founder of the Trust for Public Land, and I was on the founding board, and I was there for, I'm still on the board 47 years later, I was, as Huey was, very creative in thinking of things that the Trust for Public Land could do. It was not then the august organization that it is today. It was a scruffy band of hooligans who were going to save the world. And we did. We did more projects up and down California, begging, borrowing, stealing, doing whatever we could to make these things happen. So we did projects. Our very first project, I think, was in Marin County. The next one was in Los Angeles. Then we went on to play up down the coast. We've saved more coastline in California than any other organization or any group of organizations. We've done a chunk of the California coastline. All comes to the same little group of people, the Trust for Public Land. So is that, and we, from there, we went on to national stuff. I mean, the organization today is truly legendary in its accomplishments. The number of acres we've saved are in the countless thousands. The land that we've saved public agencies, because we buy and sell to them cheaper than they have to pay, is in the multiple billions. We've raised, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, $30 billion in 1 year by doing conservation easements and conservation transactions and bonds and such that raise money for public benefit, for public land acquisition. It's become a very, very huge and sophisticated and very successful organization. So I when I talk about my little podunk things in the backyard, what I really get excited about is what we did with the Trust for Public Land.
So it seems that you weren't inhibited by convention. Your intense and rather fresh-sounding curiosity about what are things, why are, you know, things that are here, and what are they doing here, and you know, just sort of, you seem to have an inquiring mind.
I'd like to call that, as my Zen friends say, beginner's mind.
Beginner's mind.
In the conservation world, I have a beginner's mind.
Yeah, it seems, you know, in talking to you, I can see you just don't accept other assumptions. You start fresh.
Fresh.
And then you go along in your collision course wherever it leads you.
You bet.
That's a wonderful way to be pushed and thrust and examining, you know, all things, actually. It's and been highly successful for you, and gratifying as well.
Gratifying, successful, and I've been very fortunate in working with people. He was just one of many who have, if not exactly the same attitude, they are unbent and unbowed by tradition or by practical constraints, and I am a cheerleader for, let's do it! Let's just get it done!
Just jump. So the community of people you've been involved with, you found each other in this area, Huey and others,
yeah,
and reinforced each other's, you know, in all ways. Talk to me about community in this, the Mill Valley area, the Marin County, the people that you, maybe you could talk a little bit about the people that you've been moved by or inspired by or affected by in some way, your cohorts.
Well, what we've been talking about so far is almost entirely having to do with land transactions and such. That's just a small part of the life of my incestuous exuberance has led me to. I've been a good chunk of my time here in Marin has been spent with filmmakers and musicians and artists and others who needed assistance or somehow needed my assistance, and that was thrilling for me. So I've worked a lot with, for instance, filmmakers. I worked with George Lucas for almost 40 years, John Cordy, the same, Francis Coppola for 15 years, 20 years, found him a law firm so that I didn't have to do that anymore. But I love creative people.
Mm-hmm.
Filmmakers are no different than any others. The film that you know about, the Rebels with a Cause film, I've worked with those good filmmakers, Nancy and Kenji. I really am fascinated by good movies, not bad movies. And I've helped to fund and promote and produce some really good movies, and that's been a real excitement. And again, they tend to be focused here in Marin County, or the people make them do. Even though George Lucas went on to outer space, he started in Marin County. And I love that relationship and those close relationships. And I've worked with musicians, not so closely, though I am myself a musician. I've had a band and I play.
What's your instrument? What's your instrument? Oh, piano.
That's
nice,
my
grand right
Steinway
there.
Behind us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've played piano since I was 12 years old or so, and love playing. And love musicians, and work closely with them, and support music here in the county. And I also am a big supporter of theater, live theater here in the county. I've formed, well, let's see. Another fellow and I created the Marin Theater Company.
You created the Marin Theater Company?
Yeah, it was We found the building, we found the money. It was a little thing run out of the golf clubhouse, and we knew it here in Mill Valley, and we knew it had to be better than that. So we went out and found the money. Ivan Putiatin and I found the money, got the idea, and created this thing, which today is the Marin Theater Company.
Located on Miller Avenue.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I helped find the money for, well, see, if I put them in the right sequential order, they're more complicated. The Sequoia Theater is now owned by the California Film Institute.
Mm-hmm.
The California Film Institute, I helped do that deal. The California Film Institute, I helped buy the Marin, the Rafael Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also helped the group that bought the Lark Theater and helped find the money for them, because I've came up with a very interesting and creative way to raise money for theaters, which is to have the people who are supportive of the theater not put money into a bank and say, I hope they do it. They buy the theater. That we form an LLC, a limited liability company. The limited liability company purchases the theater for them to be leased to the operating company, the Lark Theater or the whatever may be the operating company. And if the operating company falls flat on its face, then the investors own the theater. If it doesn't fall on its face, then it pays a very low rent and continues to operate the theater forever. And doing that, we've done, let's see, Rafael Theater, Lark Theater, Sequoia, Marin Theater Company. That was a little different. Each deal is a little bit different. But I just love making theaters happen and going to live theater.
Did you ever act?
Huh?
Have you ever acted?
Yes, of course. Can't you tell?
Yeah.
I'm a ham.
You're a ham. You really are. With a lot of energy, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know. I've acted in college, and I've acted even now in Sausalito. I've been on a stage down there a few times. So it's a big thrill for me. I love theater. And I love to see people succeed in theater. So that's what I do.
No cameos in any of the movies? Come on, you must be a little something.
No, I think that was my first big on the screen opportunity, Rebels.
Ah.
Yeah, that was fun.
In Rebels, you say, as I recall, you don't understand. That's the line from the movie
when we went to the folks that were the developers, Gulf Western. That's a different deal. When we went to the developer, they said, we've got attorneys. We're not worried about you punks out in California with your little teeny-weeny lawsuit telling us we can't develop Marin Cello.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, but you don't understand.
That's what Huey said.
We don't have, yeah, Huey said this. He said, you don't understand. These guys don't get paid. We're not going to run out of money because they don't get paid. And they're crazy.
Yeah, right.
And they're good.
I remember when the other day at the History Walk, I hope you had a good time, that you mentioned about Rebels with a Cause, the way that you felt that it, you talked a little bit about the movie and how it was, the audience and how it was to reach people. Will you mention that again for the interview?
Sure, yeah. Kenji Yamamoto and Nancy Kelly, husband and wife, he is the screen guy. She is the writer and developer. They work beautifully together, and I've worked with them before on a number of films. Not closely, but I got to know them pretty well. And when they approached me and said, we're thinking of doing a film about... Thank you. About the making of the Golden Gate Recreation Area, and we know you have a huge commitment to that and involvement in that. Could you help us do that? And I said, well, I know what you mean when you say that, because you know how to make movies. I don't. But I know how to find money. And you don't. You've never made any money on your documentaries, and I want you to make money on this documentary, to make back all the good films you've made. And you're not going to get rich, but you're not going to eat it. You're not going to get poor on this one. I want to help you make this film, make money. And they said, well, how are we going to do that? I said, well, that's why you're talking to me. That's why you haven't made any money in the films till now. There, your film has to have what in the film business we call a hook. That's what brings people in from the street. They pay money to go see the movie, and they buy the movie, and they tell their friends about the movie. And the movies that you've made are wonderful, warm, lovely films, but they don't have a hook. And they said, well, what's the hook? What's the hook? And I said, the hook is so simple. It's look, you've already said it 16 different ways, but you haven't thought of it as a hook. The hook is, this film is going to tell people to save the stuff they love. And how to do it. Most people would say, I don't know how to do it. You don't have to know how to do it. Just do it. Just go out and save it. You'll find a way. You'll make the way. So, this film is about people who do that. And that's what this whole thing about the Golden Gate National Recreation Area is. A bunch of people, I was one of them, but there's a bunch of them, who care so much. They can't be stopped. And they don't worry about money. And they don't worry about politics. They just say, we're going to make this happen. And so, it happens. At least in my limited lifetime. It has happened so many times that I'm still enthusiastic. And I think this film should tell that story. Not about me, but just about the concept. And so that's what, when you mentioned what you heard the other day, I was saying to people, and said what I sent to Nancy and Kenji, is if the hook works, when the lights come up at the end of the show, there's going to be two reactions. There are going to be people laughing, and screaming, and clapping, and there are going to be people sitting quietly. With tears in their eyes. The ones that are clapping are thinking, well, we did it, didn't we? Or we can do it. And the ones that are crying are the ones who lost it. They let the opportunities go because they didn't act. They didn't act. And I said, what do you think? They said, okay. Help us, help us. And I didn't have to say much of anything. They already knew what the hook was. They just hadn't made it into the hook. And so when they were, when the film was made, and you've seen the film, and it's a magnificent film.
So many times, I have to say.
I have been to now probably 15 at least Q&A sessions following that film.
Mm-hmm.
And when the lights come up, people are laughing, people are clapping, and a few are crying.
One of the best descriptions I heard about a person's experience watching that film, he said, I was terrified, yet I knew the ending. And yet I was still so afraid watching it.
Oh, yeah.
Because you know it's a hairbreadth away
of
another scenario.
Yeah.
But you're really just saying jump and the net will come. And I think that people need to be reminded. You know, that movie really does give you that hope that you can just jump.
And yeah, now, is we were very fortunate. I mean, the times were right. The opportunities were immense. I mean, it was there for us to do. It was ours to lose. And unfortunately, it was everybody's to lose. There were so many opportunities in the 60s and 70s that are very, very difficult to find today. Not to say that our people aren't finding them in different ways, but they're 10 times more complicated, 10 times more expensive, 10 times more time-consuming. We were there, it was like stealing candy from a baby. We were out there to save the world, and we had the tools, which was hubris.
Hubris, in a good way.
Yeah.
If you could, and but more than, because things are so much more complicated, I think, more than ever now.
Yeah.
A gentle reminder is a helpful impetus to continuing.
Yes, it is, and that's when I in the Q&A sessions that I've been in, I t- tell people, don't be put off by the complications. There's ways around the complications. You can do it. When people say it's just too complicated, turn your back, say thank you very much, walk across the street and find somebody who says, well, how are we going to do it? And then you're ready to go.
How many times in your career have you felt, in whatever you've in, whatever your endeavor is, what you're pursuing, that the shadow that follows you is, this isn't going to work out, and yet it does? What percentage of time would you say that you have that sense, like, well?
Well, I've had the sense that it wasn't going to happen more than a few times, but fortunately, almost every one of those times, it has happened. You know, you got to be a little realistic and say, is there a way? Somebody told me once, the successful entrepreneur is the one who knows he's in a dead end alley and gets out while the getting is good. But you've got to know if it's a dead end or not. And I have been pretty good about that. And also, I'm bold dogged. I mean, Jane, my good wife, told me to get rid of Slide Ranch. Doug, you're beating your head against a wall. It's not going to happen. And I said, it is going to happen. It's got to happen. It should happen.
Where does this come from in you? I mean, this bountifulness, this...
I would credit in large part to my father, who was an incredibly inspirational guy. He was born to a very serious Scottish engineer. And I think he must have switched babies in the hospital. My father was so far from a Scottish engineer. He loved life. He did wild and crazy things. I remember him telling me that he did this at Stanford. All this fuss recently about inflated balls.
Mm-hmm.
My father discovered by reading the rules of the then rules for college football, there was nothing that told you when or how you inflate the football. So he had a football with him when he played football, and he would blow it up in the field and run down the field with the football. And they'd say, well, that's not the football. He says, let's define our terms. It's a football. I've got it. I'm on the field. Prove that this isn't the football. I mean, this is Tom, whatchamacallit, the guy that's in the news these days. He was a wild and crazy person. And he wrote stories. He wrote poems. He wrote this and that. And he also then started writing plays, musicals. And he started producing them. First in the neighborhood. And then he joined the Bohemian Club. And that's when he wrote the plays, he wrote the music, he conducted the orchestras, and directed the chorus for 6 or 7 huge productions. And I've never had anybody who did all these things. And I said, well, how could you do all that stuff? He said, well, you know, you sit down and you start writing a song, and you think, well, that'd be good. That'd be good in a... There's a show here. And then I said, well, why didn't you get somebody else involved? He said, well, I always intended to. But, you know, you wanted it to be just right before you brought somebody in. And then he would do the whole thing himself. And there were great shows. Great shows. I have all the music in the basement. I play the music. Pretty ribald stuff, but okay.
Are you a member of the Bohemian Club?
Was I a member?
Are you?
No. When I saw, he gave his life to that club. He loved this stuff. I mean, it was so crazy and interesting for him. And and my mother was not a particularly interested fan of the Bohemian Club. So he spent more and more time at the Bohemian Club. Also, she couldn't cook, and they had great food and drink over there. So he spent a lot of time at the club. And when I saw how much time he'd spent at the club, I was encouraged by the club to become a member, because they knew that I wrote musicals too, which I have. And they wanted me to be a member of the club. And I said, no, I want to do that because I have 3 little kids, and I want to take much more time with them and much better care of them than my father took with me.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great guy. I loved him. Huge mentor at times, but I didn't see much of him.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be a more hands-on dad.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was how that happened. But anyway, in terms of one of my great inspirations. I mean, he was just over the top.
Well, you seem like a pretty fun guy yourself, you know. Do you think that sense of joy, that enthusiasm, has affected the people around you in your dealings? Has galvanized?
Yes. It's what gets me up in the morning, trying to communicate to others the excitement of doing cool stuff. I had yesterday, I went up to see my office manager, who was my office manager for 12 years. And she, when she left me, she's an artist, and she did a wonderful picture of a coat rack with all kinds of things hanging off of it, artistic stuff and musical stuff. And she had made a pastiche of all the things that I was involved with, and that excited me. And she said, being with you was fascinating because you absolutely have no boundaries at all. That she stayed with me for 13 years and finally went down to Santa Fe, where she is an artist. She was replaced by the lady who's with me now, who has been with me for 16 years. And when she came in the door, she said, well, what goes on in this office? And I said, beats me. Beats me. I don't know. People call, phone rings, people walk in the door, and she said, well, but you make money. I said, some people need help, and they just have not a penny. And that's
so you do pro bono work.
Oh,
as
lots.
Well.
Oh, huge. I would say I've been doing about 50% of what I've done for all my life, if you average it up, has been pro bono. I've robbed from the rich and given to the poor. I've represented a whole bunch of very wealthy, very successful corporations and developers and all that stuff, and taken that money and turned right around and supported my activities for other things. And it's all worked out. I'm not broke.
Mm-hmm. So you've managed to steal from the rich, as you say, or bring to the poor, but you've funneled money into your hometown. You've managed to, I mean.
Oh yeah.
Tell me about what it means for you to be in Mill Valley, in Marin County. Tell me, if you can, what that means to you to be the hometown boy.
Well, what it means to me, just as a citizen, just as a resident of Marin County, I'm going back to what I learned way back at the beginning. This is an incredible place, just an incredible place. There's many wonderful places. I've been around the world enough to know, I've seen some of them, but this, as far as I'm concerned, I got all that I ever need here, and I also have the opportunity here that I wouldn't if I were in Zanzibar. I have made some things happen here, and I really know a lot of people as a result. And I can help other people who are trying to do things here. That's huge for me, just huge. So the Riffel Theater, every time I walk in the Riffel Theater, I think, well, we did it, didn't we? I'm not the only guy that did the Riffel Theater. Ann Brebner, others worked with it. I only know that if it hadn't been for me, it wouldn't have worked. If it hadn't been for her, it wouldn't have worked. But I'm one of the three or four people on the Riffel. I'm one of the three or four people on the Lark. I'm one of the three or four people on the Sequoia Theater. I'm one of the three or four people on the Marin Theater Company. I'm one of the three or four people in a whole bunch of things. And I love getting a pat on the back. That's fine. But I'm not in it for that. I am in it for so that when I walk in there, I can quietly say to myself, well, we did it, didn't we? We did it.
Because you love it.
I love it, sure.
You love it. And so, take care of the things you love.
Yeah. It's a good scam, this nonprofit stuff.
What would you say, I mean, in your many years, you know, you're wise and professional, you've done remarkable things, you've had the rare privilege of being able to have success and support, community support. You've caught that wave where you were able to really make changes. you know, you've had a very privileged life in many ways to be able to take on the challenges and persevere and live in the place where you can savor those the successes. So what do you say to young people now coming in? I mean, how do you see the area changing, and how can people maneuver with these changes?
That is a tricky one. I have tried when asked, when I loved dealing with young people, and my door is always open to people who want to know something about, well, how do I do something like what you did here or did there, or what this group did or that, how do I do that? And I just say, come on in, let's talk. But when I talk to them, I realize that the vital ingredient to being able to do what I did is who I am. I read about Elon Musk, I know enough about Elon Musk. One of my sons works closely with Tesla. He's a senior guy at Tesla, there from the dawning. And we talk about what makes Tesla work. And I realized that I wouldn't want to go camping with Elon Musk, but I know what he has, and I really resonate to that. He has this feeling that we're going to do it. And that we're going to do it. I'll do it, and if I need to get out of some, I'm just going to make this thing happen. He gets consumed by wanting things to happen. And when people come to ask me, well, how can I do what you've done? I say, how are you about getting consumed with matters so that you don't sleep? How are you with putting aside a couple of weekends or maybe a month of and just concentrating on something? Are you okay with all that? Because I think that still is important. Even in this complicated, bureaucratic, busy world, I think it still takes, as somebody once said to me about what it took to succeed at Harvard, when I said, he said, well, how did you succeed at Harvard? You came from Berkeley High School and you didn't know anything. You got back here and you did really quite handsomely. He said, I don't know, I just went in there and did it. And he says, well, you have the vital ingredient, my son. Brass balls and the self-confidence of Attila the Hun. That's all you need to succeed at Harvard. And it seems to me you've applied that elsewhere. It's probably true. Probably true.
What forges brass, though?
Hmm?
What forges brass? You know, there's something before those bolts come.
It's so idiosyncratic, yeah. If my father had been a Scottish engineer instead of a Scottish engineer's son, this might be a very different story.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically saying that whatever the passion behind, you know, your interest or your concern, that passion, how consumed you can become, allow yourself to become, invest yourself in, can be the impetus to, or the beginning?
Yeah, going back again to my father, he knew no boundaries. Just like Elon Musk, he wants space. We can do space, electric cars. We do it. My father knew no boundaries. It wasn't as dramatic as Elon Musk, but it was quite dramatic for him to go from being a depression-born baby to a Scottish engineer who had no concept of doing anything other than putting food on the table, to becoming a very successful entrepreneur's lawyer. He was known as the entrepreneur's lawyer in San Francisco because he saw the world changing, and he saw it coming, and he knew how to say to people, we can do it, let's just do it, and raising money and helping people do things. And when I was a kid, I remember one thing. He came home one day. I was sick in bed, and he came home, and I said, "What do you got there?" He said, "Well, I knew you were sick, so I thought I'd bring home something to amuse you." And I said, "Well, what did you find?" He said, "I was walking by a strange music shop, and they had all kinds of strange archaic instruments, and I bought this thing, and he unwraps this thing. It's an Indian horn that's about 6 feet long and a wooden thing." And so I said, "What is it, Dad?" He says, "Beats me. Beats me. But you know, I used to play a lot of saxophone. He was in a road band, and he had, when they had the saxophone players used to have six saxophones, and they knew how to play each one. And he played to these roadhouses, and he learned a lot of instruments, and he played great piano and wrote a lot of music. So he brings out this wooden thing with a great big flare horn at the bottom and starts playing it. I said, "Dad, how do you know how to play that?" He said, "I don't know. I've never played one before."
Knows no bounds.
Just knows
what
no
makes
bounds.
A Pied Piper? You know, you wonder about that. What makes a person that becomes that force that people somehow, what attracts others to? I guess it's a bountiless, you know, just had that sense of
he was remarkable. Writing all these plays, which he did, he was always on that cruise for humor. The Bohemian Club's big and bawdy humor kind of stuff. And my mother didn't care for this humor. My brother was sort of, it kind of missed him. My sister didn't like it. My father found in me the audience. He needed an audience. So he would come home and say, "Hey, kid, listen. Two Irishmen go into a bar, okay? And then he'd start telling a story. And he'd get about three quarters of the way through the story. He said, "Now, you got the story?" I said, "Yeah, I got the story." He said, "Here's the first ending." And he'd go that, and then here's the second ending. Here's the third ending. And he would try these endings on me to see which ones I like. And I said, "Well, where did you get those endings?" He said, "Well, I heard the joke and I started thinking of different endings on the way home."
Do you do that? Do you need an audience to jump, you know, to think through things in your work? Have you?
No. It all comes out of the...
I mean, do you ever wonder where it comes from?
It's my father, I think. He was a huge influence. And I've known some other crazy, incredible people. But in terms of just... when I was a kid, he had, as you just saw, my shop downstairs. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty good shop for a little guy that does stuff as well. I can build anything down there, and I have. This whole house is full of stuff I've built. And he said, I love that place. And my sister didn't use the shop. My brother didn't use the shop. My father wanted me to learn how to use the shop. I said, "Well, okay. I'd like to. I'd really like to build stuff." He said, "Okay. Well, let me tell you something about these tools. They really are dangerous. They can cut your hand off of these things. These are big saws and big drills and big all kinds of stuff." He said, I'm going to teach you how to use them, but I'm not going to coddle you. Once I get you sure that you're started, you're on your own, kid." And I remember the first day he left me the bandsaw. Oh, God, it could have cut my finger off in a nanosecond. I worked on it for about 2 minutes with him. He said, "You got it now. And remember the two things. What you're doing is right. And if you don't pay attention, you're going to lose your finger. And I'm not going to call you. Give me a call if you need any help. I got to go to the club."
Wow.
It's amazing. Amazing.
So it's nice to hear about, you know, when you have somebody like that in your life. That's a privilege. Somebody that inspires
oh, yeah.
you and reassures you.
Oh, yeah.
You're very lucky. What is it now in present time? You've had this wonderful career and you've done these awesome things. What matters to you right here and now? You know, we're 2015. Where are your interests as far as your involvement with the area?
Well, one concern, thinking of my father and how he neglected my mother because of the club, I've neglected to some extent my wife because of my busy life.
Mm-hmm.
I really think I owe her some time.
Mm-hmm.
We've had some discussions about, she's talked about retirement, and I said, "Don't kid yourself, but I can cut back and we're going to spend some time together."
Mm-hmm.
I think that I owe her that.
Mm-hmm.
She owes me reminding me of all the time I've spent. We spent a very good life together, but I spent a lot of time in my office in a way and dealing with it. So I'm going to cut back on that. That's important to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge thing. I also, as I mentioned, really like to talk to young people and get new groups inspired. That's, I don't flatter myself. I am now an old codge. And people look and say, isn't that nice? I had a nice discussion with Doug Ferguson. He's still alive, and he seems, he's sort of
You're
peppy.
Not that old.
He's sort of peppy. But I, you know, and that doesn't bother me. I have the same self-confidence that I had when I was 15. I'm not worried about that. If I set my mind to something, I'll make it happen. But when I see people look, and they do, they say, yeah, nice guy. It's amazing. He's out and about.
Honestly, I'm sitting here. I've been interviewing for you for a while, and you are so bright, you almost vibrate neon. You've got a lot of energy there. I can see that.
Well, anyway, I'm doing and have been doing for a long time what I'd like to do most, which is to inspire others and to inspire me to do cool things.
The community you mentioned earlier about
community
the community
stuff,
continuing to work with community stuff.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. We've been talking for a while. I think we can start to close up here. Let me just take a quick look. I'm going to ask you one more question.
Okay.
Is there anything we haven't talked about today that you wish we talked about? What's missing? Anything in our interview?
There's many things we haven't talked about, some of them classified, but nothing that I feel like I need to talk about. No, we've kind of got a good handle, I think you have here, a good handle on what it is that makes me tick. If you got the secret of eternal life, I'm not interested. I don't want to live a whole lot longer than the next, umpteen years. I'm living now because I'm 76, and I hope I have a number of good years left. But I'm my age group and older are dying, and they're getting sick, and they're getting palsied, and all that stuff. And I don't want to be there. I just want to go out like a rocket.
You want to go out like a rocket? What would be the best way?
What would be the best way? Well, I have one, not a rocket, but it was a lovely thing. We had a friend who was a Supreme Court justice. And he was a member of Audubon Canyon Ranch, and he was also an avid birder and an avid naturalist. And he was out in West Berlin one day, and he said, "Oh my God, can you imagine that?" And he reached down to see a flower he'd never seen before. When I was in the seventh grade, I was in a chorus at Berkeley High School. We had an evening when a combined choruses, something like 13 choruses from all over Berkeley came to sing, each chorus, one chorus, of course. Then we put those all on the stage. Berkeley High School had a huge auditorium. So we had 13 choruses on the stage with an orchestra, and the conductor did the finale, which was Battle Hymn to Berkeley. My eyes have seen. Well, he conducted it. We sang our hearts out. The curtain came down, and we waited for the applause. Big, thick curtain. We couldn't hear anything. We just stood there and stood there and stood there. And finally, they came back and said, the conductor died. On the last note, that is going out like a rocket. I don't need anything that fancy. But show me some stuff.
Oh my gosh. Well, I think that's as good a place to close as anywhere, huh?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. It's fun thinking about this stuff.
Beautiful life you've been leading. Very inspirational. Thank you so much for sharing.